So, okay. Two mechanical things, just so three mechanical things. At halftime, you have to do the evaluation, or as we call it, student revenge. There's also, for those of you who haven't yet done one, these salmon-colored things are for evaluating the student advisor. If you haven't done that, you should do that as well. Can I just see, so I can organize my life accordingly, a show of hands of people who are intending to attend the open session next Wednesday? Oh, all right, enough people to make it worthwhile. Okay, just check, since my colleagues seem to be flying off and going home and things like that, and they're turning out the lights in the building, just bring a candle. And then the other thing is just not a matter of democracy, but a matter of just interested in hearing your thoughts. We're in the midst of thinking about our teaching for next year. And next semester, I'm pondering three possible courses. One, simply straightforwardly, on Kant's Third Critique. A second, a modification of that on the Third Critique and Schiller's Aesthetic Education letters. And then something altogether different, a course on Sartre, Beauvoir, and Butler, Being and Nothingness, Second Sex, and Gender Trouble. Can I just see... And this is just for advice to help me get my eye in. Roughly, who would prefer the first, the straight concert critique? The second alternative, Kant with Schiller. Just a couple of little Schillerians in that. And the third on existentialism and feminism. Why don't you vote it twice? I will take that under advisement. Okay. We are in the middle of the unhappy consciousness. Again, just to catch ourselves up, I have been claiming that the unhappy consciousness is the reflective comprehension of the fact that self-consciousness is itself mediated through another. That is, that self-consciousness, the forms of self-consciousness, stoicism, skepticism, the unhappy consciousness, are each attempts to make sense of the fact that self-consciousness is both independent, a form of freedom, a form of self-determination, and dependent. And that divided structure of self-consciousness is given through its genealogical emergence in the master-slave dialectic, and that the forms of self-consciousness stoicism, skepticism, the unhappy consciousness are the reflective attempts to make sense of that original genealogical setting. Make sense of that initial experience of coming to self-consciousness about being a self-conscious being. Remember, my account is not that master-slave is the genealogy of self-consciousness. It's the genealogy of our coming to self-consciousness about our being self-conscious beings. And in that experience, we discover that our self-consciousness is mediated. Mediated by a powerful other. And that we are therefore essentially divided consciousnesses. Stoicism, skepticism, the unhappy consciousness, are reflective comprehensions of that self-consciousness about self-consciousness. So it's kind of three levels of iteration, right? Being self-conscious about being self-conscious about being self-conscious. And that the problem of being a divided consciousness comes to fruition, so to speak, in the experience of the unhappy consciousness. The unhappy consciousness as a certain philosophical reading of the meaning of Christianity. At the level of individual experience. I'll say something about what that means at the end of the hour. But at the level of what Christianity does for the individual in their understanding of themselves as a divided consciousness. So not yet Christianity in another form, which we'll talk about later. So this is a philosophical... So this is Hegel for the first time using an institutional practice, in this case that of medieval Christianity, in order to, or the claim is that what religion does, what that practice does, is provide us with a form of self-understanding. Which should not be surprising. Why else would one become a Christian? Did not provide us with a form of self-understanding. But it provides us with a particular form of self-understanding, namely of ourselves as a divided consciousness. And the aspects of Christian belief, three aspects are here looked at: devotion, sacramental desire and labor, and self-mortification. These three aspects of the unhappy consciousness are three ways in which this form of divided consciousness, namely one that takes the unchangeable to be its essence, to be its true self, right? God is my true self. He is the creator. I am his creature. I am his nothingness. He is my essence. So I recognize myself in him, right? So the very fact of that is a mediated self-understanding. That's something that religion knows, essentially, that mediated self-understanding. I'm saying myself through God. And yet, because of the structure of that difference, namely, he is up there in the beyond, unchanging, and I am down here with my flesh, with my body, then I have to make sense of that fact. That is, that his beyondness and my changeableness, my finitude. Now, there's one further twist here, and the further twist is Christianity always thinks about this problem at its core. And it thinks about this problem at its core because the claim of Christianity is God has some benighted benevolence or masochism. Masochism is the more plausible. Came to earth in finite form. God became man and died on the cross. The incarnation is the fundamental fact of Christianity. That is, that something about the structure of Christianity from the get-go says that there is no essential gap between finitude and the infinite. That the very fact that God can happily, God takes on this finite form, wanders the earth, does a few tricks, goes back home. That's one version of the story. The fact that he does that is already its indication that somehow the gap between unchangeable and changeable is itself not ultimate. Now, nonetheless, we've discovered that would be okay, except for the fact that the son of a bitch, we call Jesus, died. And therefore, it's as good as if he hadn't been here. I mean, what's the point of having someone who incarnates and then leaves, right? So the incarnation is a kind of bit of a cheat, right? He both said, I'm actual, I'm real, I'm just like you, but the grave is empty. The grave is empty. So in a way, the emptiness of the grave is in a way what the unhappy consciousness is trying to get over, get round. So it's still struggling. It's still struggling to make sense of that relationship between the finite and the infinite. And Hegel takes it, and this is, again, Hegel being much, much more interesting, I think, than theology. If this was a theology course, I would now launch into many hours of lecture on the Trinity. And I take it that it's not an accident, as Harris notes, that when the church wanted to punish Abelard, I have a deep, deep love of Abelard. The History of My Calamities, a little tiny book you should all read. Abelard I always took as the first rationalist in the church. His Sicce Non is a great rationalist doctrine, I think. And he really argued, and I think this is why the church cut him off, so to speak. put it lightly. That he argued that faith must meet the criteria of reason. That was unacceptable. And hence the first thing they did is make him repeat ad nauseum the Athanasian Creed, which of course is a creed about the status of the Trinity. And of course, if you read it, it's unintelligible, right? So at the heart of Christianity is gobbledygook. And the place of gobbledygook, that is the unintelligibility of the Athanasian Creed, is the marker of the incapacity of religion to think the relation of change of the three aspects, namely God is universal, God is finite, God is spirit. Right? So Trinitarian creeds are, so to speak, the hiding of the fact that there's a failure of thought here. Now, Hegel's, the greatness of this text is that he does not repeat the Athanasian Creed. He looks at religious practice, at cultic practice, in order to understand through those practices itself what the experience of a believer is, not some theology, but to understand the meaning of Christianity through the experience of the believer, trying and understanding that those practices are themselves the way in which the believer works out the meaning of that direction between changeable and unchangeable, particular and universal, finite and infinite. That it's those practices that are the key to the meaning of Christianity. And this actually runs through all of Hegel's reading of religion. Namely, he understands religion through cult practice, not through theology. So it's an institution with sets of institutional practices, and you understand the meaning of the institution by looking at the structure of those practices as themselves a working out of its deepest set of commitments, its forms. Hence, the account of devotion, of the Crusades, which is where we left off last time, and now the movement to sacramental desire and labor. Okay, are we all on the same page-ish? Ish. Okay. So, let me do the overview of this section and then say a bit more about it. The form of the unhappy consciousness takes, after the failures of devotion and the discovery of the empty grave, is to take seriously the fact that life as appearance cannot be voided. But rather, we should think of the earthly life as in truth, God's gift. And hence, in thinking about it in terms of gift, it reveals a different way of thinking about the nature of our dependence. Because the gift here is the gift of life, the gift of life on earth. So instead of repudiating or trying to identify, we'll come to repudiation, but rather than merely trying to identify with the beyond as devotion does, here we take seriously the life of everyday human activity. Which is, say, everyday desire and everyday labor, which is what our life amounts to, desire and labor. And therefore, we begin to think that if life is dependent on him and his gift, then, and if he is our essence, then we should labor not for ourselves, but for him. That we must interpret our own worldly activities as the fulfilling of this gift, which, because it's a gift, we try to return it, as it were. We try to give back by fulfilling the desires, by, as it were, working hard and having a sense that we're working not for ourselves, but for the other. And this, again, is deep in how one... if you did a sociological survey of just ordinary working people. And, you know, you ask them what they were working for, I'm sure the vast majority would say, for my family. That is, no one works for themselves. That is, we dignify the meaning of work by thinking of work as not a form of self-assertion, but a form of self-sacrifice for the sake of something beyond ourselves, something larger that we belong to. And if we're religious, to think of it as indeed working for the very being who gave us life and the earth. So, in this case, this form of practice of sacramental desire and labor, as I'm calling it, takes seriously the incarnation, but thinks of it like its own life as something to be sacrificed to the unchangeable world from which it came. Hence, Hegel argues that this form of consciousness conceives of both its abilities and its doings must be interpreted as gifts, and those of you who do contemporary political philosophy will know that the most debated aspect of Rawls's theory of justice is his theory that we do not own our own ability. Ownership over abilities. So, Hegel says, no, we don't own our abilities. They come from God, they don't belong to us intrinsically. Therefore, we do not own the results of our practice, and therefore, in order to act, we must act in the mode of thanksgiving, in the mode of gratitude. So paragraph 220, the end of the paragraph, Hegel says, the relation to actuality is the changing of it. So the first thing is, what's my relationship to the world? Well, my real relationship to the world must be my changing of it. That's what we Christians do. We build the world. We change it. We alter it. We make it into something. Or working on it. So the idea of the original slave labor is now another form of slave labor, not now under the form of coercion, the original experience of the serf, but under the form of gift and gratitude. I defy. I have certain skepticisms about recent appropriations of the gift. They've got to be theological. They've got to be theological. And it's the most, you know, it seems to me the most atrocious theological moment in Derrida's thought is his account of the gift. And his argument is exchange. Both his accounts of exchange and the gift are severely mistaken, I think, of which the book on Baudelaire, in Time,
what's that, Given Time,
Given Time is just easily his worst book. Easily his worst book. He never thanked me for telling him that. He'll get his revenge.
So the relation to actuality is the changing of it and working on it. The being for self, right? The point is here is by working on it, whatever else you may think, there is a moment of being for self, right? Even if you're in the mode of gratitude, even if you're in the mode of thanksgiving, right? This is the mode of the being for self which belongs to individual consciousness as such. But in this relation, it is also, not one or the other, but also in itself or has intrinsic being. That is, it also has the master moment. So this is the surf having the master moment. This aspect belongs, forgive me, happy consciousness, to the unchangeable beyond and consists of faculties and powers, a gift from an alien source which the unchangeable makes over to consciousness to make use of. So, roughly then, this dialectic works out as the unhappy consciousness attempting through its independent initiative, through its laboring and working, to demonstrate its absolute dependence. And clearly this is bound to be self-defeating. For the more it labors, and the more successfully it labors, and the more it desires for the sake of the Lord, the more it necessarily feels its own extreme independence and individuality. So, two-thirds of the way through paragraph 222, Hegel says, similarly, even in its giving thanks, in which it acknowledges the other extreme as the essential being, and counts itself as nothing, this is its own act, which counterbalances the action of the other extreme and meets the self-sacrificing beneficence with a like action. If the other extreme delivers over the consciousness only the surface of its being, yet consciousness also gives thanks, and in surrendering its own action, i.e. its essential being, it really does more than the other, which only sheds a superficial element of itself. The superficial element of the other is that it's in the beyond. And that's just surface. The beyond, as philosophers call transcendence, for Hegel is just surface. Not a deep property, but a shallow. Why? Going right back to the introduction. Essence must appear. There's nothing about any transcendence that can matter to us other than in the ways it appears, other than in the ways it's taken, other than in its formations. Thus, the entire movement is reflected not only in the actual desiring, working, and enjoyment, but even in the very giving thanks, where the reverse seems to take place in the extreme of individuality. So the thought is, this form of consciousness wants to think of itself as divided, so on the one hand it wants to think of itself as working, and then it wants to have a reflective relationship to its own working, which it calls giving thanks. But the giving thanks is itself its own way of appropriating the meaning of its very own action. So even in the giving thanks, it's asserting itself. Consciousness feels itself therein as this particular individual and does not let itself be deceived by its own seeming renunciation. For the truth of the matter is that it has not renounced itself. What has been brought about is only the double reflection into the two extremes. The result is the renewed division into the two opposed consciousness of the unchangeable, etc. Okay. So, there is Hegel's claim. No way of actively performing the renunciation of oneself as an individual that is finite, working and laboring and desiring, that does not end up as a form of affirmation. Because the only way one can renounce one's individuality is to do something. And every time you do it, you affirm your authority, and hence you affirm the inviolability of your singular individual will. Paradoxically, then, performance of renunciation becomes the occasion for a grand and endless action that effectively augments and individuates the self it seeks to deny. And if you're a sociologist, you just want to now just begin reading Weber on the spirit of Protestantism and capitalism, the spirit of Protestantism. Just goes right from here. That is, right from this moment, you go right to how this spirit, this sense of working on the world, increases and increases and increases this form of individualism. Right? Which is what Weber argued, till the point where the fact that it's being done for God just doesn't have a chance. Right? It just gets eaten up. Swallowed. Nine. So, there is a moment here of unsurpassable enjoyment, of satisfaction. And the satisfaction occurs because there is an inevitable form in this laboring and doing of self-affirmation. So he says, paragraph 223, return from this external activity, however, consciousness has experienced itself as actual and effective, or knows that it is in truth in and for itself. In work and enjoyment, which make this unsubstantial existence a reality, it can directly forget itself. So it's this moment of enjoyment, which Hegel is just thinking the enjoyment of accomplishment of action. You know, it's that double consciousness. You know, your parents say, you know, you must mow the lawn, sweep the
garage, whatever your parents miserably tell you to do. And the deep thing is you resent it like hell and yet feel satisfaction at the same time when you accomplish it. And you can't get rid of that duality of resentment and satisfaction. And, of course, that makes it worse, right? Because you don't know what to do with your own sense of satisfaction because you resent.
Isn't giving thanks designed to cover that over?
Of course, yeah, right. It's trying to make the superego into an ego ideal. Right. Never works. Okay, now, so by recognizing that everything I am and do is given to me by the grace of God, I do indeed, Hegel is claiming, experience my unity with God. But nothing can alter the fact that I take God's gifts, including the gift of freedom, and use everything he has given me in my own way. So as Harris rightly says, the cycle of desire, labor, and enjoyment is all mine. And even if it is God who lays the desire upon me and sets the limit to what I can do, when I come to the enjoyment, I must recognize I am actually enjoying the exercise of my own choice. So the contradictoriness of the unhappy consciousness arises from the inviolability of the unity of mind and body in an actual embodied consciousness. That's the only way you can read this section. That is, the contradictions arise from the inviolability of the unity of mind and body in actual embodied consciousness. Now, this leads me to a large, not so large, a little aside. And the aside is on the status of labor in Hegel. And I'm here just tracking what Harris says on pages 417 and 418 of his text. But it's worth bringing in. And it's worth bringing in because Uncle Carl argued, I quote, labor as Hegel understands it and recognizes it is abstract mental labor. That's the crux of Marx's critique of Hegel. Everything else is just, you know, smoke and mirrors. The crux is the interpretation that labor, as Hegel understands it and recognizes it, is abstract mental labor. Now, if my interpretation of the unhappy consciousness is right, then that thesis is just straightforwardly false. Whatever Marx's critique of Hegel is, he better not rest it on that foundation. Right? So we know that the labor, going back to the master-slave relationship, that the labor of the serf was physical. And only superveniently, namely as a mode of afterthought, does its mental side arise as a result, namely the contemplation of the form, right? Essentially, it's a doing, but
in the mode of Stoicism, I abstract from the doing because I want to imagine my freedom of thought, right? But, of course, that's what Hegel's going to criticize. So serfdom, for Hegel, is labor in its most stringent sense because it is both involuntary and enforced. The labor of the unhappy consciousness is self-estranged. Not involuntary force, but self-estranged. Almost, you might say, a Marxian category. So, on the physical side, it is both voluntary and compulsory service to natural need, which is broken into by the enjoyment of both the satisfaction of accomplishment and of satisfied desire. And of course, on the other side, it is voluntary service for God. But the voluntary service is indeed purely mental, and it is indeed what is important to the unhappy consciousness. And it's because of this that this unhappy consciousness, in its laboring, can conceive of itself. In its laboring, can conceive of itself as free and universal. Because I'm laboring for God.
Which I do.
Yeah?
I'm still confused on this on the voluntary service to God. Insofar as it's a practice of devotion, surely it's not entirely mental. I mean, you go to church, you do various things.
Right,
and smoke and all that kind of stuff.
Right, but remember, this is not about the devotion side, this is about the thanksgiving.
So, even in Thanksgiving, there's a set of, I thought the point was that it's a set of practices.
Well, it's going to be a set of practices that's going to be governed by an attitude. It's the attitude of Thanksgiving that Hegel is concerned with. Of course, it has a version of it. You give over a tithe. You know, there's all sorts of ways in which it's manifest in very concrete sorts of things. But it's the way it's a dual practice, right? Is that the laboring is a mental physical activity of doing, while the thanksgiving is the reflective comprehension of it. So it's still voluntary, even if it's there's some cult of practice. So, the point here, however, is that this thanksgiving can, of course, not make any difference at all to or in the beyond. That the only significance of thanksgiving is the experience of the working and laboring itself, and the argument again here is the experience of working and laboring is always going to be one in which I am transforming the world physically and socially all the time. That is, Christianity is nothing if not world making, even if under some illusory horizon about in whose service or for what reasons. Hence, in this world making, it will give on to the Protestant ethic, that is, modern faith. And in modern faith, in the life of the Protestant ethic, it will literally become Bildung, that is, the cultivation of itself as it makes the new world. but it's making all the time. I mean, this is the argument against Marx. There's no moment in this in which Hegel does not conceive of these activities as literally physically constructive. Now, the conceptual opposition, therefore, between the concrete physical on the one hand and the abstract mental on the other is an opposition that belongs to Greek society and in a certain moment of bad faith to bourgeois society. What I mean by that is you go to Wall Street every day, you are ruthless, you are cutthroat, and you go to church on Sunday. So you have your moment of working on the world, of making it, of affirming yourself, of doing all that stuff, and you have the purely mental side of I believe. Which only in America does this continue to exist. But anyway, this form of bourgeois life, it's like America is like a museum. So we can understand the phenomenology. Bourgeois life is still like that? How did that happen? We need another course to understand American religion. Because American religion is not cult. Okay. Let me have a segue. It's actually important. Why has religion not faded from America? Because in America, I think religion has never been essentially a social practice, that is, a cult practice, that is governed by a church with a series of practices, and that the institution of belonging to the church was the essential thing. In America, religion has always meant sect, where sect has always been interpreted as individual salvation. That is, the relation of the individual to God. And the thing about sect, right, is that it can not only exist under conditions of fragmentation and dissolution, but it can thrive under these conditions. That is, it doesn't need to be in competition with the state. It doesn't need to have institutional... Right? It can thrive on isolation, loneliness, fragmentation, dislocation. It has its core there. So that all the ways in which, in European nations, in complicated ways, and sometimes very recently, right, in cases of Italy and Spain, has the church lost its power by the state taking over some of the integrative arrangements of the church and taking responsibility for it. You can read the writings of our colleague upstairs, Jose Casanova. This is what his research is all about. But in the United States, because we have not had that kind of institutional church, then that usurpation of the experience of a secular society has not occurred. So you do have something very odd and curious here, that is this continuation of early, very early bourgeois Protestant experience. Hence, the dualism, which between them, concretely physical and the mental, between the 6 days of the week and Sunday, which is the concrete manifestation of that, right? Which a former bourgeois society upheld.
exactly what I meant by practical, just that the division between mental and the actual is itself...
Oh, it has practical, yeah, of course. And that's absolutely right. And all I want to say is that division does not exist in Hegelian philosophy. Right? There is no mental self-making in Hegel, which is not essentially physical making of the world at the same time. Free labor, Harris rightly suggests, is the identity of human thought and action. So Hegel, I don't want to say that Hegel's not an idealist, not one of those other Hegelians, I think Hegel is an idealist. Whatever his idealism is or means, it's not because he thinks it all happens up there in the domain of ideas. It has something fundamentally to do with the structures of laboring activity as self-conscious institutional practices. So it is unsurprising, therefore, that there is going to be something ultimately self-defeating about Thanksgiving. And this, by the way, this argument about Thanksgiving is still there in lots of contemporary forms of Christianity. Obviously, all this stuff about the gift relationship, the way it's come back. But even McIntyre arguing that thought, philosophy, is really just a sublated form of prayer. I guess you have to live in South Bend, Indiana for that to make much sense. But, and even there. Okay. So, if the relationship between mind and body is inviolable, then the full recognition that the full recognition of God's giving, as it were, places me in my body as a free acceptance of my embodiment. That's the achievement of the gift moment. Let me be clear. The achievement of the moment, when it gets absolutely right, is it leads to the free acceptance of embodiment and laboring. But then it finds it's another form of self-assertion. So the problem then becomes the problem of the will. It's not that I can quite know what to do with my body, although my body remains a problem. But it's my will that seems to be getting in the way. I seem to be asserting my will. And it's just that which is going to lead to a new relationship, that of self-mortification. Let me say what this is, and then we'll have a break, because I have a lot to say about it. The last form of the unhappy consciousness, and again, remember what I said before, all of these forms now continue. Now we should be hearing so that on the one hand we move on to another one, but unlike earlier accounts, they're not quite sublated because they each have their own structure of temptation, which is one of the things I'm trying to illustrate, is they carry on as contemporary forms of self-understanding. The last form of the unhappy consciousness is one in which it seeks to divest itself actively completely of its initiative and its embodiment as of worth at all. So just taking the extreme view, having, as it were, failed to find a mediated way of getting back its body, this is going to be the attempt to systematically disidentify itself with its will and embodiment. So rather than enjoin its activity in the service of God, it mourns and agonizes over each and every element. Which is to say, its real goal is to reduce itself to nothing. To achieve, as it were, the nothingness of its inessentiality. That is, if my activity and embodiment are truly inessential, are truly worth nothing, then I want them to become nothing. And hence, I want my inhabitation of the world to become nothing. That is, I want to reveal worldliness itself as a nothing. And the way it does this and there's a contradiction here, is through a focus on its animal function. Paragraph 225. So, the claim is here is this full construct takes its own reality immediately. A nothingness. Its actual doing thus becomes a doing of nothing, its enjoyment a feeling of its wretchedness. Work and enjoyment thus lose all universal content and significance, for if they had any, they would have an absolute being of their own. Both withdraw into mere particularity, which consciousness is set upon reducing to nothingness. Consciousness is of aware of itself as this actual individual in the animal functions. These are no longer performed naturally and without embarrassment as matters of trifling in themselves, which cannot possess any importance or essential significance for spirit. Instead, since it is in them that the enemy reveals himself in characteristic shape, it's the devil. They are rather the object of serious endeavor and become precisely matters of the utmost importance. This enemy, however, renews himself in his defeat, and consciousness, in fixing its attention on him, far from freeing itself from him, really remains forever in contact with him and forever sees itself as defiled. Etc., etc. Break, repeat, stop. So, the guess everyone makes here is that neither eating nor sex are matters that Christianity has traditionally repudiated. After all, the Eucharist itself involves a bit of nosh. And Christians are supposed to procreate a lot. So the thought here is that the mention of animal functions is on excretion. And the question about whether and what Hegel knew about Luther roughly what people wonder about. Luther, notoriously, there's a important book by Erickson called The Young Luther. Erickson, one of the original Frankfurt School psychologists. And in The Young Luther, Erickson deals at length with Luther's constipation. Luther apparently spent hours a day in the bathroom, in the privy, and I guess his assumption was if he spent hours a day in there, this must mean something, right? And he assumed what it meant was it was the devil trying to reduce him to his bodily functions, and hence his fight with constipation became the signature of the idea of what spiritual fighting meant. So that if he could somehow, you can go on the web and check all this out. I'm not making this up. Indeed, I think it was in the mid-60s, I'm embarrassed I know this, they actually discovered the privy, the bathroom where Luther did all this. This was a great discovery of lots of stuff going on in Wittenberg. Well, the comedy of this is also the comedy, I want to say, of the abject. That Hegel's not doing this by accident. It is exactly looking at that moment of our physicality over which we lack control fully, and which places us within the animal kingdom, essentially, not just an embodied, incarnated Christ, but this is, I will repeat it, a piss Christ, something that then, so that the difficulty now is that is what's Luther's problem? He cannot find the place to draw the line between the physical and the spiritual. So he's turning back on that physical and on being unable, the experimental vision here is the inability to, as it were, draw that line, is the experience of abjection. Abjection is the experience of the lapsed boundary or border. So this last form of the unhappy consciousness is indeed a form of abjection in the most profound sense. And that Hegel has this sense of what? The ultimacy. The irony here is the ultimacy of a religious consciousness as it tries to enact that difficulty of divine consciousness ends up in abjection. Ends up in abjection. Okay, let me hand out these things, or one of us pass them around. Can I have someone to volunteer to collect them up and give them back to the dean's office wherever they go? Yeah, Ken, thank you very much. I'll give you two envelopes. Let me get another envelope. And we'll have a little longer break, because I know you'll need a break at the do your worst.